What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Michael O'Connell. Michael O'Connell was a probationary fireman during September 11th, 2001, with the FDNY. We discuss his experience on 9/11, and we also discuss, perhaps as or even more importantly, the aftermath, his involvement with John Feel and the Feel Good Foundation, his part in the fight for the Zadroga Bill, which we go over in some detail. And now I give you Michael O'Connell. Okay, I'm here with Michael O'Connell. Michael, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm very excited to be talking with you and to hear your story. Before we jump into how you brushed with history, Michael, please tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, my name is Michael O'Connell. I'm a retired lieutenant from the New York City Fire Department. I think first and foremost, I'm a father of three great kids, and I'm very fortunate in that sense because I didn't know if that was actually going to happen for me, knowing the past and what we're about to talk about. But I'm married to my beautiful wife, Rebecca, three awesome children, Aiden, Colton, and Allie, two boys and a girl. And I base my whole life around them. Truthfully, that's kind of who I am. I do a lot of coaching. I'm a stay-at-home dad, but, you know, I've retired fireman. I'm Mr. Mom, shuffling them from one field to the next. I'm coaching them in everything. I'm doing a lot of kicking and screaming along the way, but truthfully, I wouldn't have it any other way. I'm living kind of the life that I think I was supposed to live. I'm raising these kids the best of my ability, and I'm trying to have fun along the way.
That's the good stuff, man. I appreciate it. I'm happy for you. So yes, let's jump right into it then. Could you please describe the experience of getting the call about the World Trade Center 2001?
Yeah, so just a little backdrop. I got on the New York City Police Department in 1998. So I wasn't kind of shy to civil service. I was 22 years old. I was young, very immature. Getting on the cops kind of prepared myself, for what was in store when it came to emergencies. And then I had gotten on, I got the call for the fire department when I was 25 years old, May of 2001. So only a few months shy of 9/11 hitting. And believe it or not, I was a probationary firefighter. We were still in the academy, although I was in the field doing field training at Engine 273, Ladder 129 in Flushing, Queens. That day on 9/11, I was home on Long Island, and a friend had called and he had worked in Brooklyn. He wasn't a fireman, but he had a private business in Brooklyn. He had seen from his office that the first tower had been hit and that there was billowing smoke coming from the tower. So with that being said, I threw the TV on, and just like most people, when you're watching the scene of what's going on, you see the second plane go in. And right then and there, realizing what it is and being a terrorist attack and knowing that the first one wasn't an accident, what do we have to do? Every cop, fireman, civil service, we all got recalled into the city. And like I just told you, me being living on Long Island, Nassau County, I worked in Flushing, Queens. It's probably the fastest I've ever get to my firehouse. I probably made it there in about 15 minutes from here to there. Beautiful, morning. Flew in, got there. Obviously, these guys were already ready to go. And the fact that we were first due Shea Stadium, which is the Met Stadium, previous Met Stadium, now City Field, we were first due truck engine to City Field. They used the parking lot of Shea Stadium as a staging area to send, fire companies in. So they already had buses ready to go. The captain, Shelley Barakas, who is now deceased of 9/11 cancer, I was under his wing that day along with a couple other senior men of that company. And we were in teams of four, one officer, three firefighters. And we got on the bus, all teamed up, not really knowing what we were in store for. Coming down the West Side Highway, that stage of the game, the towers had already collapsed. So we were getting communication from the site into our bus. And then we were being told that, there were numerous planes hijacked. We had heard about the plane that had gone down that hit the Pentagon, and the plane that had gone down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. So just like everybody else, you kind of know you're under attack. You don't know what's happening. And me being 25, being extremely young and naive to not just the world, but the fire department, only having a few months on, you know, I knew to just keep my mouth shut, my eyes open, my ears open, and just do what I was told. We got off the bus, and with the collapse already happening, a lot of people already still making their way towards us, filled with debris. They were covered in debris. I happened to run into a couple of firemen that I knew. Thank God they got away. And our job at that point was to get to the site and do what we do, is, you know, search, rescue, and see if we can get any sort of life out of there. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. You know, we weren't successful on that front, as you know now, but we were determined. Like I said, I followed my captain and the team that I was on down there right away, instantaneously from the outskirts, just trying to sift through debris and see if there's any kind of human life that was alive at the time to get them out of there. It wasn't too much of a, it wasn't a graphic scene, is what I could tell you, is because, you know, you're talking 220 stories of office building, and you're not realizing that day, you're talking all of that office space, two towers down, how many people are in that building, what are we going, coming up upon? And I could tell you that it was almost like being on the scene of a movie, because it was something that I grew up traveling into Manhattan with my family, coming over the 59th Street Bridge, or coming, you know, downtown area into the Williamsburg Bridge. You saw those towers up, and to like now walk into that scene where they're not standing anymore, and you're talking X amount of space that's just now just huge piles of steel, dust, rubble. It was completely like shocking. You know, it was something that you couldn't kind of comprehend in the moment. But I guess the job in itself and knowing kind of what you were there to do kind of took over, and we went in there with the best intent to try and help. The outskirts of it was, you know, a little bit more of a scene for us, because people that were trying to run away from the building weren't successful. So those were like the first kind of casualties between people that had jumped and people that had kind of just tried running away and weren't successful at it. So we did our best job to give those people the best privacy we could for them, and help in the best way we could. And as the day progressed, you know, you started realizing that, you know, you weren't going to be successful here. You know, knowing as we were going through the day, you know, in the hopes of, you know, finding somebody, finding one of our brothers. I mean, you know, you're on a team, you know, in that moment, you know, you're in the firehouse, but you know that, you know, throughout the city, there's 8 to 10,000 firemen, and there's a total recall. Like, how many guys did we just lose? And that's kind of like also surfacing in your brain. And at the time, being 25 years old, I'm not married, I don't have children, but that's kind of like weighing on me, because like part of the job getting on and seeing these guys and meeting some of their children at events and stuff, you know, they're just like anybody else. They come, they do their job, they're amazing at what they do, but they go home to be a dad, to be a mom, to be, you know, a brother, a sister, a son. And to know that, you know, we were losing without question number of guys, like typically losing one fireman in a fire is complete devastation. Losing 343 in one day is almost unheard of. It's never happened on the, you know, fire department history, something to that magnitude. And I was, you know, in the midst of experiencing something that that you didn't really know how it was going to take shape, not just, you know, loss of life, but the reaction to it, and how many children no longer have their father, how many women don't have their husbands. And the biggest memory for me, which, you know, kind of, even though I don't get to be a fireman anymore, it keeps me going, the memory of these guys, because some of them were near and dear to my heart. You know, I lost six guys from my probie class. Anthony Rodriguez stood right next to me through each month. He was married with three children that day, and his fourth was born, I believe, on September 12th. And I believe the baby's named Hope, in the hope that daddy would come home. And unfortunately, we didn't find Anthony along with the five other of my brothers from the academy. I lost dear friends from high school. Mikey Kiefer was lost that day. Somebody who was just totally enamored with being a fireman, always knew what he wanted to do, went and did his job. He only got a short time to kind of accomplish that mission, but he accomplished it on a day that, you know, goes down in infamy. But the memory that sticks out to me that I was just about to tell you was, you know, when you're a fireman, you wear Scott packs. You know, it's a breathing apparatus that helps us breathe in a smoke-filled environment. Attached to that Scott pack is an alarm called a pass alarm. And if you're laid motionless for a certain period of time, it lets out like a loud screeching noise to basically tell us as the guys that are in the job, somebody's down. The pass alarm's not going off. We can hear them. They might not be able to communicate to us, but we can go get to them because the alarm's being sounded. Well, when we had first arrived on that scene and the hours and maybe even a few days that passed, that's all we heard were those pass alarms. So that was our brothers underneath that pile that we couldn't get to. It's a memory that's etched into my brain. It will never go away. It's something that, you know, when I do these interviews, I talk about, because you're talking about selfless human beings that kind of put everything aside, their wives, children, own safety, their own, you know, passions in life to run into that building to make sure that they got somebody out. And they accomplished more than I will ever in my life. And I lived through that, knowing those pass alarms that they went in to get human life out. And they did it extremely successfully. They saved thousands of human beings from dying that day. And then to hear their alarms going off and they were no longer with us. It's a memory of mine that I try and just hold near and dear to my heart to basically let it be known to myself that, you know, who do I have to be, you know, as a human being? You know, try and be selfless, try and, you know, be a good human being, try and take care of others, try and, you know, give more than I take. And I learned that lesson that day. You know, I was probably a punk kid, 25 years old, 22 when I got in the fire, you know, the police department, 25 in the fire department, just running around, having fun, you know, immature in life. And, you know, that day, you know, taught me a lot. And it taught me kind of how to grow up and be a good human being, or try to be at least. And now I'm trying to raise three human beings to do the same. And I'm hoping that they don't have to learn that lesson off of a day like that. And they'll get it through maybe my knowledge and what I went through. And maybe, you know, there will be some experiences that they'll learn, good and bad. But those pass alarms going off is something that will, you know, forever be etched into my brain. And those guys, those 343 brothers of mine, along with the police department, Port Authority guys, anybody that gave their lives that day to help others, you know, it's, they forever changed my life for sure.
Wow. That's extraordinary, Michael. Thank you so much for sharing that. It's heartbreaking. You know, there's something I wanted to share with you, actually. So I recently interviewed another survivor of 9/11 named David Paventi. He was in the North Tower at the time. He was on, I think it was the 86th floor. And as you probably know, the first plane, I think it was, hit the 92nd floor that day. But I wanted to share a quick story with you and just kind of get your thoughts on it. It sort of speaks to the idea of just how selfless these guys, your brothers, were. So he tells the story of leaving the North Tower and coming down the stairwell. And this is a slight paraphrase, but I want to read it to you and get your thoughts. He says, "I'm going down the stairwell and here come these guys in full gear with packs of hoses and just carrying about 40-pound bundles of hoses and big axes and all this stuff. And they're heading up the stairs and to go into the fire. And it was eye-opening for me. One of the firemen stops on that turn and has his hand on the railing. He looked up at us and he said, 'I get to do all this for $35,000 a year.'" And this is when he was looking up at the numberless stairwells. And he says, this poor guy is drenched in sweat, running towards God only knows what, and they have no idea what's going to happen. It was eye-opening and a little gut-wrenching at the same time. Do you have anything to add to that, Michael?
I could just tell you that just through the training and knowing what these guys kind of endured. I mean, you're talking, they're carrying 40 pounds. They got 80 pounds on their body. And your normal human being having to race up, you know, with the stairwells, the only means of access with the elevators down. You know, most people can't climb up 80 flights of stairs on a good day when they're in decent shape on their own. If they had short sneakers and what do you call it on, and a t-shirt on. These guys, you know, they're built different. It's a different breed. When you can put yourself in that environment where, you know, you look at your brother next to you, and if he's going, you're going, kind of mentality, that nothing's really going to stop you. Very rarely, maybe, I can't even tell you on my hand. I've heard stories of there being firemen that kind of have bailed out and gone the other way. But, you know, again, I've never seen it with my own eyes. This is a brotherhood. They take care of one another. And more importantly, they realize they're going into a situation where there's a chance they're not coming back out of. You know, that's every day you wake up and you go into these jobs, whether you're being cop, fireman, you know, correction officer, any of these lines of work, EMT, because this day and age, I mean, you still don't know. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be gunshots or fire that take somebody out. You know, they go into these environments and they're going to help people they don't know. I mean, it's just rare. It's a rare commodity that somebody I think is born with that has that in them, that they'll go and put their own life on the line and what their passions are and their family and their friends and their loved ones to know that, you know, they're going to go do the best job they can to help. They're going to kill themselves as they're going through it. And I mean, physically, like, you know, I know what that's like, you know, having to race up, you know, 30, 40, 50 flights of stairs, carrying those hoses. These guys went up 80, almost 90 stairs, flights of stairs. You know, it's amazing. It's not surprising to me. I mean, I can tell you that, like, I like the fact that the gentleman made mention of it, that it's something that stuck out to him. You know, the finance part of it, I mean, me knowing a fireman, I guarantee the guy was just breaking balls. Because, like, if you're in a firehouse with, you know, there's single firehouses that have 25 to 30 guys in it. There's other firehouses that are double house that have 50. Trust me when I tell you, a good bulk of them are big-time wise asses and some of the funniest people you'll ever meet in your life. And if I was in that stairwell and heard the guy say it, I tell you, he's probably trying to get somebody to chuckle. Because even in the darkest times, these guys can kind of make light of any situation and try and even maybe console them in a way where they're going to get themselves out of there and cracking a joke every once in a while is something that I think, you know, is a good trait to have, because he might just be making light of a situation that was real shitty.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense to me. Thank you, Michael. So, Michael, getting then into the aftermath, can you recall what the days following September 11th were like? What the rest, I believe that would have happened on a Tuesday. Yes. Do you remember what the rest of the week was like for you?
So like the rest of that week, I mean, my crew was there, I want to say somewhere to like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning into Wednesday, into September 12th. And it was really just, you know, day led into night and then night led into the morning. The aftermath, you know, my company was there probably till about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning of September 12th, Wednesday morning. And the majority of the time from like day into night, most of the time was spent, I mean, you know, there were guys putting water on the fire that had lasted for well over a month. It was crazy. We had jobs from like the early start of the day was really just getting down there and trying to search the area, the surrounding area, to see if we could get any survivors. Then it led to kind of running in out of buildings to shut a lot of water mains down to get increased pressure into the area to kind of like, you know, submerge the fires, which, you know, was a tough task in itself because those fires raged on for, you know, a good more than a month. That led, and during that time, you know, Shelley Baracus, like I told you, had passed away. He had saved our company's lives because, you know, the two towers had come down, but as most people know, you know, there were many other tower, you know, buildings that had collapsed. And I was on the block at 7 World Trade Center when it came down. And if it wasn't for Shelley, Captain Baracus, you know, myself along with the crew that I was with would probably no longer be here. You know, he had kind of taught us that, you know, if we're in a crappy environment and the building's going to come down, we have to run at an angle away from the corner of the building because it's going to come down and kind of like shoot out, pancake out, and you get hit with some debris. So there was a police officer actually standing right next to Building 7. He flew up to that guy, ripped him off the building, and told us to go because he knew the building was coming down, and we just got off that block unscathed. So from that moment on, you know, it was a lot more work to do with all these buildings coming down of just like, you know, search and rescue. and the Bucket Brigade had started. And like I said, day led into night, and that job really never let up for about 8 months. And just that week alone, it was kind of, we were there, and when you were there, you were working. And you were doing your best to see if we can maybe get one of our boys home, find somebody, because, you know, you got to keep hope and hope that there might be a pocket. There might be some sort of area where maybe somebody's found. And there was not an extremely a lot of people, but some of our crew was found, you know, thank God. But if you weren't at the site, you worked a 24-hour shift at the firehouse. So I went the next day, I worked at my firehouse on the 12th. The next day, right back to Manhattan. So I went on and off for like a good week straight. I was either at the firehouse working a tour to man the firehouse, or get back on the train, somehow get back down to, you know, ground zero and start digging again. So that was kind of, you know, our schedule per se. And I was gone. I don't think my family saw me for well over a week. And that's kind of what we did. If we weren't at the firehouse, we were there. And it just went on and off. And it slowly started progressing where they started, you know, coming up more, with more of a schedule, who would be down there, who wasn't going there. And like I told you, I was in the fire academy, you know, as per my title, being a probationary firefighter. I still hadn't even graduated yet. 273, 129 was like my field training. I was there with Robbie O'Corn. How you got put into your area was just by alphabetical order. So like, I believe they started in Manhattan where, you know, Richie Allen and Calixto Nyer, two guys in my probie class, they passed away that day. They were down on South Street Seaport. Mike Camarado was in the Village. He passed away. And then it went through your alphabetical order as to how they chose your field training unit. My last name, O'Connell, my boy's name, O'Corn, they put us in Flushing, Queens. It's just how you kind of felt. My boy, Anthony Rodriguez, the R's were in Brooklyn. You know, that's kind of where it was. That's how we lost his life. So even a crapshoot when it comes to things like that as to why some people are here and why some aren't. You know, it's craziness of that day. I've kind of, 20 years have gone by, right? I mean, I went through the whole roller coaster of being on the job. I graduated. I went on to Engine 285, Ladder 142, where I started, you know, really at my career, it kind of flourished and went on from there. I transferred from Engine 285 to the truck, Ladder 142. I was doing truck work. I started studying for lieutenant. I got promoted to lieutenant. And then in 2007 is when I got sick and I got diagnosed with a rare autoimmune disease called sarcoidosis. And during that time frame of like from 9/11 to graduating to getting to my firehouse, you were hearing stories like it's still young, naive. I didn't realize what was still going on as to how guys were getting sick after the fact. You know, you had your asthmatics, and then you started seeing as the year went on and progressed into year after year, guys started developing cancers and it started getting more prevalent and, you know, picked traction. And then in 2007, I'm home with my wife. She's pregnant, 6 months pregnant with my son. And it was clear as day because it was December 31st. We were living in our first apartment. We had a few people over. New Year's Eve night, she's 6 months pregnant, so we're not partying too hard, but, you know, we're celebrating New Year's. And on January 1st of 2007, I couldn't even get out of bed. And I wasn't hungover. I literally was like somebody walked into the bedroom and literally beat the shit out of me with a baseball bat. My body, within that maybe 6 to 7 hour period of time that I fell asleep, literally blew up to twice the size of what it was. I had welts and blisters and bruises all over my body. My joints were all inflamed. You know, right away, my head's wrapped around like, what is this? Like, obviously, I got sick. Something's going on. Is this like mono? Like, I never really had any serious illnesses or health side effects in my life. So I didn't really know what was going on. So going to the doctor, I just went to a regular internist. They did a chest x-ray. She then sent me to a hospital where my brother worked and called in a CAT scan. And later on did I find out that doctor looking at me, talking to my wife, and we're very fun, jovial people. Me and my wife, we like to joke around. I told you about Feynman, big time wise asses. I'm probably clowning around in front of the doctor. And she's looking at my wife being 6 months pregnant. And all she had in her mind was this guy's got such an advanced case of lymphoma or some form of cancer because I can't even see his lungs on this chest x-ray. She sent me directly to the hospital and called it in to the staff where it said his brother works there. Let's get this guy in right away. There was a staff waiting for me. They put me through the CAT scan and now they're sitting in a room and they come in. And like her initial assessment was the same as theirs. Like, we have to get you upstairs, get you in a bed, and we're going to biopsy one of these lymph nodes because this is not looking good. And although they, you know, he didn't kind of say these words to my face. It was more like, he's my brother, and his reaction is Irish stoic guy. Like, he's, you know, doesn't really get emotional. Like, he broke down. My wife's crying. It was like, this is serious. And, you know, there's a chance he doesn't have much longer to live. Like, that's how advanced it is. So, you know, I went through the day waiting, trying to, you know, everything pondering in my head, thinking like, I maybe I have mono. What the hell's happened to me? I mean, I have fevers. There's like crazy shit going on to my body, not knowing what's going on. Not until later on that afternoon did a pulmonologist walk into the room. He took the sheets off the bed, like, to look at my legs, and he saw those blisters all over me. And he didn't even say anything besides this. He says, you have nothing to worry about, kid. You're going to be fine. So I'm like, all right, well, I just went from like dying to like, I'm going to be fine. Like, what is going on? He said, you have, in my opinion, and I'll have this confirmed through testing, but you have a rare autoimmune disease called sarcoidosis. Something environmental got into you that's making your body react this way. And you're going to go through shit for a good period of time. But with the proper medication, proper treatment, you know, and the right care, we should get you back to tip-top shape. So I went off of that assessment. They did something. They sent me to specialists in Manhattan like a few days later, where they did a biopsy of my skin called the Kavime test, and it was 100% accurate for sarcoidosis. So that being said, I was to be able to, I went through a lot in those like few months that I was out on medical leave. I was sick. I was able to battle back and go full duty and get promoted and be a lieutenant and stuff. And then sure as shit, not too long after me getting out of lieutenant school and me bouncing around as a lieutenant, I went into a high-rise office fire, took in a little bit more smoke, and I was right back in the hospital. So right then and there, like, they were trying to work with me, but at the same time, the doctor, one of the head lead physicians at the fire department, FDNY, basically said, you know, Dr. Prezant, genius of a doctor, basically said, like, you know, I think, you know, it's time we have a conversation, because, you know, it seems like any bit of smoke or environmental, I guess, substances that are getting into your system is going to poorly react to you, and you're going to have this kind of side effect every single time. So he let it be known that most likely my fire career was over, which was, you know, extremely, you know, heartbreaking, because I just not just started on the fire department, you know, before that. That was kind of what I always thought was my calling. Like, I love being part of a team, love the brotherhood, love being in the firehouse, love running into burning buildings. I mean, it was, I love helping people. It's, you know, it's kind of what my passion is. And to be told that you can't do that anymore was like gut wrenching, you know. So the next phase of my life kind of moved on from there to, like, you know, see what, you know, where's this going to take me?
Yeah. Wow. Thank you, Michael. I want to actually use that into a springboard, because I do want to talk about the 9/11 compensation. So I think I'll ask you, how is it that you came to be involved with John Feel?
So after, like, the dust settled on me not being a fireman anymore and me having to retire, you know, my son Aiden was born in April. I was blessed with having my son Aiden. I was still on the job when we had my son Colton. He was born in 2009, and shortly thereafter is when I retired. So having two little guys at home, you know, we were growing our family. My wife was working. I was home playing my Mr. Mom. I think it started affecting me in a negative way where, you know, although I love being a dad, you know, I'm a 30-something-year-old guy who's always, you know, being a cop fireman. I volunteered my time, you know, when I was younger. I was always in this thing to kind of, like, you know, to help. And to not be able to, I kind of went and sorted out myself. So I was told that there was this, you know, there was these lawsuits and all this other stuff that's coming involved. And, you know, just doing the best job I can for my family, because I couldn't work anymore. Obviously, I wanted to, you know, hear about what's going on and what can I do and what involvement is there with all these lawyers calling me. I'm like, there's got to be more to this. So they kind of put me onto that. There's this group of men that have been traveling down to Washington for the last somewhat years. And they've kind of taken the government on themselves. You know, they put, you know, the 9/11 community on their back, and they're down there fighting, you know, for these women that are home now without husbands, for these children that don't have their fathers anymore, for the men and women that are getting sick from the effects thereafter. So I found them online, John Feel Good Foundation. I made the phone call. John put me in touch with his number one, Richie Palmer. These are two men that, you know, selfless and firemen and cops and running into a burning building is, it's something that's unheard. You know, it's just, it's incredible. And I've talked about that before. But I put these guys up there with them because, like, although, you know, Johnny was a steel operator, managing steel operator, where he was, you know, taking care of the cranes and whatnot that's going on, and had a major catastrophe soon after 9/11 where a steel beam had crushed his foot and had to have it amputated. Richie Palmer was a warden at Rikers Island, big forefront guy down in 9/11, handling a lot of, you know, citywide administrative stuff, handling his guys. To meet two guys like this and their team and of firemen and cops and volunteers and, you know, women that had shops that were down in lower Manhattan that had gotten sick. I mean, there was, you know, students from Stuyvesant High School now getting sick. They formed like this team that were traveling down to Washington on their own dime, on their own time, leaving their families, you know, just like the firemen and cops do every day. And they're taking up their own time to go down there and walk the halls of Congress and fight with the men and women of this country that is supposed to be protecting us. And at first, just like being a probie on the fire department, I went down there. I kept my eyes open. I kept my ears open. I kept my mouth shut. And I learned kind of their way about fighting our government for the betterment of the 9/11 community. And it didn't take too long. Being young and having the ailments and the illness I had, you know, and them getting to talk to me, they realized that I had somewhat of a head on my shoulder and I wasn't going to kind of screw things up for them. Johnny made me a team lead. And he's like, listen, you got a head on your shoulders. I love your story. The fact is, you're not your typical 55-year-old, 60-year-old that's, you know, lived life this long and gotten sick. You got sick at 32 years old from a rare autoimmune disease that, you know, normally doesn't affect, you know, people your age. He said, so you're a perfect story to go. And he said, the fact that you could speak, I want you as one of my team leads, and you're gonna take these guys for as long as it takes and go down there and put up the fight. And that's what we did. We'd walk in and out of these Congress senators' offices, request meetings, again, very unsuccessful for a good portion of it because they didn't want to hear from us. They know it was going to cost them money, you know, and I'm not into politics. I don't like politics. I'm to sit here and tell you what side I'm on, I am very gray. I'm not white. I'm not black. I'm not Republican. I'm not Democrat. I mean, I hear, I have my eyes and ears open. I listen. And I try and make the best decision that's going to work, not just for myself, but for the people that are around me. And that's what their job is to do. They are servants to us, the best help us. And that doesn't always come through, I can tell you. And especially from my experience and what I've seen down there, there was a lot of pushback. There was a lot of lip service. There was a lot of bullshit. But when you sift through it, you somehow try and find the people that are best trying to help your cause. And I mean, how could you not want to help people that are experiencing what they're experiencing due to 9/11 illnesses? I mean, we were lied to. The air's safe. Go down there and work. The air's safe. Go back to school. You're fine. You can drink from the water tank fountain. You can go have lunch in a cafeteria. The air's safe. Yeah, children that are in kindergarten, go back down there and go back to school. I mean, are you shitting me? So, like, knowing all that, I said, looked at my wife. I said, I don't care how we have to figure this out. I got to go and I got to be there. So for the last, I guess it was the 5 years that I went down there to kind of help and take those meetings on. I've took, I'm not saying countless trips, but I can't count how many trips I went down there, how many hotels I spent, you know, how many hours I spent in hotels with these guys. And I built a brotherhood with them. And we went down there and we didn't take no for an answer. And I went from meetings with just regular heads of the department to I went face to face with Mitch McConnell, you know, in a meeting there. So I'm proud of that effort. I like to think that my time spent down there with my brothers and the guys that I was down there with served a purpose. We got 90 some odd years of compensation and health care for the 9/11 community where you hope that they don't have to worry. I'd like to think that we'll expand that list of the ailments that will be covered for them beyond cancers and other respiratory diseases beyond that realm, because here we are, we're 20 some odd years later, we're coming up on the 21st anniversary and people are still sick and they're still dying. You know, I'm part of Johnny Field's Feel Good Foundation. And every year we go and I ring the bell, the amount of names that we ring for that year of guys that pass away. And I can tell you that for the last, I don't want to say 6-7 years that I've been doing it, there's not a year that goes by that I'm not ringing that bell over 150 times.
Jesus.
So it's still very real. It's real to a lot of people. So that time spent down in Washington was something that I hold near and dear to my heart. I like to spread that message. I mean, Johnny has me going in and out of schools. A lot of these kids that are in schools now, they weren't even alive during 9/11. So it's like, you know, it's part of history,
right,
what you're doing here. You know, I like to get the message out there to have people realize that, you know, yeah, a terrorist attack had come, hit us, but those guys flying those planes into the building, all they did was make a nation stronger. And we've had our hurdles over the 20 years of politics and who's in leadership and who's not. And racism still very much a big part of life. And people need to realize that, you know, we got to come together as a group. You know, we got to come together as human beings in a society and do things better, you know, be better. We got to go back to September 12th, where it didn't matter where you were, whether you were watching it on TV or you were down at Ground Zero or down at the Pentagon, you were trying to lend a hand or you knew somebody that was there or you tried, you know, being an open ear to somebody that experienced some bad shit. We came together as a nation. There was never more American flags went up. September 11th was one of the worst days in the history of the country. But although September 12th we were hurting, it was one of the best days because it's kind of like when you woke up a sleeping giant and we came together as a nation. And a lot of stuff gets thrown at us, you know, whether it's terrorism or racism or politics or, you know, pandemics, now things overseas. You know, you got to realize that human beings resilient and you have a heart, man. You got to use it and you got to be a good human being. You got to back each other up and be there for one another. And the minute that we do that and support one another, we overcome everything.
Yeah. Beautiful. Beautifully said, Michael. Michael O'Connell, this was in honor, truly. You're a hero to me, to America. It was such a pleasure. I'm very grateful to you for taking the time for me.
Yeah, no worries, brother. I appreciate you because, listen, like I said, you know, that happened and shit's going to happen in our lives. Somebody like you that's still sharing these stories, the guy that was in the North Tower that got himself out, thank God he got out. There's plenty of stories out there. There's plenty of good in the world. And we need people like you to go out there and put this message out there that there is good. And listen, there's always going to be bad, but we need good to prevail. And we don't need another September 11th to help us recognize that. We could do it today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael. I think I've taken up enough of your time. Thank you so much.
All good, bud. It was a pleasure meeting you. Anything else you need, you got my number. You reach out to me.
Thank you, man. I will. You take care.
You got it, brother.
All right. God bless.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.